You are listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with Rafa, celebrating the sport and producing the finest cycling clothing since 2004. Today, we're in Montauban.
My name's Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And tonight, once again, we are joined by Seb Piquet.
Bonsoir.
Seb is, of course, the voice of Radio Tour, and he joined us, I think, for our preview show, Seb. And we're delighted that Julian Alaphilippe is still well up there overall, because you have promised if he wins the Tour, you will not walk naked into Paris.
Maybe I should make another bet.
Okay, well, we'll look forward to that later on. We've got lots to pack in again tonight. We're going to hear from Bernie Eisel, teammate of Mark Cavendish, who won the stage. We're going to hear from Tim Harris, who knows Dan McLay very well. He was third on the stage, and Dan McLay lived with Tim Harris in Belgium for 4 years. We're going to hear from the Dane. And I should point out my joke last night. I do know that Macbeth is the cursed Shakespeare play. I was making a joke that it was Hamlet.
Because Hamlet's a Danish play.
I know,
isn't it?
It was sort of an equivalent.
It went over my head.
A few people have pointed. especially being Scottish myself, I should know, and I do. We'll hear from the Dane, won't we?
Eminem.
Lionel. We'll hear from the Dane later on, who was our peddler de charme yesterday. Anyone else we'll hear from? Any other?
No, I think that's it today, isn't it?
Oh, that's it. Okay, well, let's crack on with the tale of the étape.
Okay, stage 6 from Arpajon-sur-Cère to Montauban, 190.5 kilometres. Another fairly tame day in terms of action out on the road. A two-man break. Yukiya Arashiro of Lampre, the Japanese rider, and Jan Bartha of Bora were away for a lot of the day. They were reeled in with just under 23 kilometres to go, and from that point on, it was clearly going to be a sprint finish. Direct Energy did a lot of work for Brian Cockard, perhaps a bit too much, because several of their riders were off the back with a long way still to go to the finish, and Cockard was he wasn't up there as he was the other day. The sprint was between Mark Cavendish and Marcel Kittel, and it was a Dimension Data rider, Mark Cavendish, who got it, his third stage win of the race, 29th of his career, now overtaken Bernardino in the list of all-time stage winners, now only 5 behind Eddie Merckx, and the catch might yet be on.
It's back on, isn't it?
I mean,
it was written off, but it's back on.
There was a bit of daylight between Cavendish and Kittel. It wasn't as close as some of the sprints we've seen this week. Britain's Dan McLay was third, his best result of a terrific opening week. We spoke to him a couple of days ago, or you did, didn't you, Richard? And we'll hear a bit from Tim Harris, who knows him very well. So the situation with the jerseys, Greg Van Avermaet is still in yellow, convincingly so, 5 minutes 11 ahead of Julian Alaphilippe. Mark Cavendish has taken the green jersey back from Peter Sagan, who slipped to third behind Kittel. Thomas de Gendt is in polka dots for the second day, and he'll take that jersey into the mountains tomorrow, and Alaphilippe is in white. There is a little band of brothers gathering together at the back of the peloton now on a pretty much daily basis. Sam Bennett, the Irish rider, Michael Murku, the Danish rider, who we'll hear from later on in the episode. They were crash victims from day one. And Lars Back from Lotto Soudal, who crashed very hard at the end of the Giro and was pretty much given no chance of starting the tour.
Lars is at the back, is he?
Lars is at the back. They all finished together, 6:26 behind the peloton. And it could be a really tough day for them tomorrow, because we're flirting with the Pyrenees on stage 7. The finish is at Lac de Payolle, and the first category climb of the tour, the Col d'Aspin, will be covered quite close to the finish.
Well, it was Cavendish again. You know, he's sort of his best tour since 2012. That was the last time he won 3 stages, but he's done it here in the first week. You know, he back in 2012, it was towards the end that he added another couple. So he's in tremendous form, and it must be very tempting now to consider going all the way to Paris, because I think, you know, there are two schools of thought. I know that certainly Doug Ryder at Dimension Data has been talking up his chances of going all the way to Paris and then going straight to Rio for the Olympic Games. But I think there are people in the British cycling setup especially who don't envisage that at all.
Yeah, well, he's been showing amazing performances so far. Will he be fighting for the green jersey. That's the other question. He's wearing he's back in green after his victory today. That's another debate. Will he carry on to Paris to try to win it?
He doesn't think so. I mean, he thinks Sagan is untouchable in the green jersey competition, and in the long run, that's probably correct. The sprint was exciting. It was pretty chaotic. Etix Quickstep came very, very late, didn't they? And I think that's been a deliberate ploy. Direct Energy went too early, but Lotto Jumbo were very present as well, trying to help Dylan Groenewegen, who lives near Anne Frank's house in Amsterdam, I learned today. But he came from miles back in the day, so they were trying to position him well. Then he lost his lead-out train, and he was kind of, you know, couldn't quite execute as well as he did the other day. So, you know, it's a difficult puzzle. It's not quite as straightforward as, you know, trying to get your man in the right place. So it can still go wrong. He was actually up there again. He was seventh on the stage. But Dan McLeay, I mean, is he somebody you knew much about, Seb, before this tour?
Yeah, well, we saw him win on French territory a few months before the tour in impressive fashion. The video was seen on Twitter, I don't know how many times. But all this is very interesting because in 13 years doing race radio on the Tour de France, I have never sort of seen a stage finish. So you're telling me what happened today.
Of course, so you don't get to see the stage finish.
Tell us exactly where you are.
I'm in the red direction car number two, so basically behind the pack. And so I never see the stage finish.
Well, you do
especially for sprints.
You do have a cracking view of the race. I mean, especially in the mountains, that's when your view gets really good, doesn't it? But a lot of comments this week about it's not been so far a great tour. And Lionel and I were talking about this. Well, I mean, that's a very subjective view. There have been quite a few stages where an awful lot, where nothing much has seemed to really be happening. And there haven't been many crashes. And we sort of said the unsayable. Do crashes make the tour more exciting?
That's terrible to say for the riders, but indeed, it's the first time since, I think, 2005 that there are that no riders have quit the race. We still have 198 riders. It's also linked to the geography. We were speaking to Christian Prudhomme just a few minutes ago, and he was saying that, the stages are linked to geography. When you have a Grand Départ in Normandy, for example, well, obviously, you will have four or five stages on flat roads before eventually getting to the mountains. And to the Massif Central, which was the case yesterday.
Are the stages too long? I mean, our shorter stages, there is a distance to be covered, so it's practical. I mean, you could add more transfers, but is that a factor as well?
It may well be. I mean, we had three long stages back to back, including the one into the Massif Central, which, you know, it's understandable that they would take one of those days very, very easily, and they did. They took the first of those three stages incredibly easily. I mean, they were a long way down on schedule, on the slowest schedule, and there wasn't a lot of action. And people have made the point that the smaller teams, really, the onus falls on them to get in the breaks and make the breaks bigger. So it's not just one or two riders or, you know, getting away, that it's bigger groups of five or six. But, of course, it's easy to say that when you've got a peloton whose job is to basically regulate how many riders get in that break. The peloton is dictating how many riders go up the road, not the riders who are making the breakaways. And Seb, you'll know that because you get to see that, you know, first 90 minutes of racing when the break is trying to establish itself. But in terms of the geography, I mean, France is France, and it isn't a case of just going out and picking what route you want to do. It's all about years of planning, towns and regions putting in funding and bidding to host stages and putting together an incredibly complex jigsaw puzzle. And then this is the canvas we have, and the riders are the artists who can paint some pretty pictures on it. We just haven't seen a lot of masterpieces in the first week.
And talking about canvas, we did have stages of over 230 kilometres. Why? Because you have to find the stage cities. And the cities that were chosen because they wanted to welcome the Tour de France were cities far apart. So obviously that's another factor to take into account when you organise the Tour de France.
But of course the riders always make the race. And you mentioned that the start of stages is when a lot of the action happens. We don't see that. Nobody usually sees that, although some stages are being broadcast live. But generally speaking, we pick up the race, or TV picks up the race, when the break is established. Seb, you have a view, or certainly you know what's going on in those early stages. Has the race been less aggressive, or have those early kilometres, the first hour of racing when that break is being established, has that been as aggressive as ever?
on normal flat stages with obvious bunch sprints, those stages will finish with a bunch sprint. Sadly, that's the way it is. It's not aggressive at the start. The riders have and the teams have too much at stake to battle it out in the first 30 kilometers. So when a rider from Fortuné or from a smaller team takes off, well, that's fine with them. And you have what happened 4 days ago when you had the rider from Fortuné, Armindo Fonseca, taking off. He was actually riding at an average speed of 30 kilometers an hour. And the pack was at 29 kilometers an hour. There was a big debate about, you know, the most aggressive prize to be given, and one of the members of the jury of that prize is actually in my car, Thierry Gouvenot, and he didn't want to give the prize at all.
So within the organization, you know, is there frustration at a stage like that? I mean, are they sort of tearing their hair out, thinking this is bad for the tour?
No, because they are all, or most of them, in the case of Thierry Gouvenot, is a former rider. So he's been on the bike, he's witnessed those difficult stages in sometimes very tough conditions, and he understands and he will never criticize the issue of a stage.
We get a bit of criticism, don't we, sometimes for saying, for being critical of the riders for not riding harder.
Well,
when
it's a tricky one, isn't it? I mean, I think it's difficult to... I understand the argument that, you know, we want to see blood and thunder racing every day for 21 days. Of course we do. You know, and the spectators who are watching on TV, people at home, they want to see blood and thunder racing. But I think it's dangerous to say that a call for kind of more aggressive racing is also a some kind of way of condoning doping or encouraging doping, or saying that, you know, the Tour de France is a very hard event. It's supposed to be very hard. It's supposed to be a 3-week contest to find out who's the toughest over 3 weeks and can cope with everything that's thrown at them. But I suppose you have to temper it, don't you, and accept and appreciate that the riders will try and make life easier for themselves when they can, and that's fine. But it doesn't make it, you know, when people are turning on 2-3 days in a row and there's not an awful lot to talk about. But then, you know, I think back to the late 90s when Mario Cipollini would win 4 stages in a row, say, or there'd be 7 bunch sprints out of the first 8 days, and that was the Jean-Marie Leblanc style Tour de France. We haven't got that. It is more varied than that. So I'm not being overly critical, but I think the day where Fonseca was up the road on his own, not racing, the bunch was behind, not racing, it's fair enough to say that was a day when they didn't race.
Listen, we should hear from Bernie Eisel. I spoke to Bernie Eisel at the finish, obviously delighted that his teammate, an old pal, Mark Cavendish, won the stage. I put it to Eisel that he's been a key factor in Cavendish's revival. They've been apart for a couple of years since Cavendish left Team Sky, and they're back together this year, and Cavendish is on fire. Here's Bernie Eisel.
Bernie, you're obviously the secret weapon, though, because you and Cavendish haven't been together for a couple of years. You're back. A few people have said that you're quite an important influence on him, not just in the race, but off the bike as well. Is that something that you would acknowledge?
Off the bike, yes, and definitely on the bike. I mean, he trusts me. But it's the same time, we also have to find back together in the race and understand him, how he works. I just do the same thing as I did a few years ago, and I also, as I did with Team Sky, it worked well there. People were happy, so I'll keep doing that. Just changes a little bit. I have to bring him a little bit further. Today it was carnage, but as long as he stays with me and stays relaxed, we're happy.
I mean, a lot of people obviously talking about HCC High Road, but the bunch sprints have changed completely, haven't they?
Yes, I mean, we're not HCC, we're not High Road. We're a bunch of great people, especially with Reiner from Rendsburg. It's just another team that didn't want him. We would sign him for the next 10 years if we can. Same with Daniel Declan and Otto Nuttall. They're just doing what we tell them, and it just doesn't matter if it's kilometre zero uphill. Daniel, you have to be there, follow the moves, he's there. So the commitment of everybody is just amazing. Steve Cummings, you know the images when Steve Cummings rides last in a bunch. Steve Cummings is in the middle of the mix and just riding at the front and doing everything he can for Mark and for us. And so it's just, it's just incredible.
You said you were surprised to see the sort of form Mark's in.
A little bit, yes, because, we're not getting younger, so that's for sure. I said, okay, we're probably good to handle the pressure, but that it unfolds like this. It's just the train scenario. I mean, it's not that we didn't train for it or aimed for it. It was just so far away. And especially for him, I think, crashing in Harrogate and losing everything there. Like, going in there with the big train to win the stage and getting yellow. And ride around England in a Great Britain in a yellow jersey. Didn't happen. And now it happened. 2 years later, it happens here. It's just incredible.
So that was Bernie Izzell. Seb, you had something interesting to say about Bernie Izzell. I was asking him about the comparison with HCC High Road, but you had something to say on that.
Yeah, well, his role is still extremely important for Mark Cavendish. It's not the same role he had a couple of years ago when he was at HCC or at Sky with Cav. He is no longer a real lead-out man. He's no longer really concerned by the train in the final moments of the stages. But he has a different role. He just takes care of Mark, goes to get his bottles. He's with him in the gruppetto. He is an expert in time delays in the mountains. But he's no longer the Izzell of HTC.
And his role in the mountains, you know, they're like brothers there, you know, and he really shepherds them through the mountains. There are funny stories about them falling out on the road. You know, there was a story a few years ago when they were riding the Col du Tourmalet and they had an argument and they weren't speaking to each other. And they rode up the Tourmalet on opposite sides of the road until eventually Izzell went back to the team car, got a Coke for Cavendish. They always sorted out their arguments with a Coke, a kind of cold Coke from the car. Peace offering. He said it was like feeding apples to a horse.
And of course, Mark Cavendish captured his 29th state victory. He's in front of Bernard Hinault now. I actually asked him what it felt like, and he said, "Oh, I hadn't realized." Because he was more focused on the birth of his niece. His brother gave birth to a little girl, and so he wanted to dedicate his victory to the little girl.
Darcy. I think it's time for...
Good evening, chaps. Unfortunately, not joining you live this evening. The Free Boss Files production team is still marooned at the finish. Mark Cavendish crossed the line about an hour and a half ago. I think today he supplied definitive proof that he really is back to his best. That's been a question that's been asked of him and his team many times this week. And I wouldn't say dodged the question, but they have caveated their answers on numerous occasions, said, well, you know, it's a different era now to the one when Cavendish came onto the scene. Different sprinters. Mark is a different kind of guy. He's a different kind of sprinter. He's at a different point in his career. However, I think the memories of his dominant period in the Tour de France have become ever more prominent in our mind this week, because it really is like going back to those years, 2008, 2009, 2010. In particular, today, the way he freelanced and surfed the wheels and really relied on instinct, didn't have a lot of help from his team in the closing kilometre. And as I said, this really reminds me, well, in particular, of his debut season and 2007, his near-pro season with T-Mobile. I think he won 11, 12 races that year. Didn't get an awful lot of help in most of those races. And the fascinating thing about Cavendish back then was just this visceral excitement that he seemed to take from sprint finishes, and he seemed to give us from sprint finishes in that era. And you know, we all learned to dissect a sprint finish in a way that we hadn't perhaps prior to that, by virtue really of the way he would describe his sprint finishes, dissect them. You know, I had the good fortune of working with Mark on two books, two volumes of his autobiography, and when we were working on the first one in 2008-2009, I vividly remember him diving around his unfurnished living room, reenacting all of his sprints, and with as much sort of passion and involvement as when he was racing. It was really quite extraordinary to watch. And had a good chat this evening with Rolf Aldag, the Dimension Data technical manager, who I know has been on the podcast quite a lot this week. Rolf was in agreement, really, that the last 6 months, and in particular spending a lot of time on the track, have really given Cav back that taste, that appetite he had for sprinting without much help, really relying on his instinct, on his impulses, and that was always one of his great strengths. He was a fantastic racer, and it's something that he's almost maligned over the last few years, the fact that he's almost been railroaded behind his train, the train that he wanted, the train that he demanded, the train that he was entitled to have. But it perhaps has sort of deadened his racing instinct to a certain extent. And I think over the past few months, racing on the track, riding for Dimension Data, who cannot rely on the same caliber of train perhaps as Essex Quickstep or even Lotto Soudal, I think that's really in a strange way helped Cavendish, and I think we saw that today. Plus, he has so much confidence now after three stage wins, or after two stage wins, he had so much confidence that his decision making now in the final kilometer is back to its very best. His vision is so sharp of those situations. He makes, as he always used to say, you know, you're making 1,000 decisions in a matter of seconds in those situations, and that was always one of his great assets. And I think that he's back into a groove where his mind is working very quickly, and he sees situations develop, he anticipates situations develop, and he also has fantastic speed in his legs at the moment. So he's making it look quite easy, and really has turned the tables on Marcel Kittel. Marcel Kittel looked as though he had a bit of an Indian sign over Cavendish, and he certainly had the psychological edge over Cavendish until this Tour de France. Cavendish, of course, had never beaten him, and now really the boot is on the other foot, and the same applies to Andre Greipel. So good to see if you're a Cavendish fan. Having said all of this, the sprint finish that I really wanted to see today and didn't get to witness was the one between, which I presume occurred between Lionel, the Lion of the Chilterns, Burnie, and Richard, the Buffalo Moore, because I hear they were out on their carbon fibre folding bikes this morning. And yeah, it was a bit of a ding-dong battle by all accounts. So hopefully we'll be seeing some video footage of that, not just selfies and Twitter posts. We actually want to see the live film reel from that Titanic clash, or future editions of that Titanic clash over the next few days. Hope you can oblige, guys. In the meantime, I will wish you good evening.
Eurosport, the home of cycling.
And now, Pedaleur de Charme.
Thank you very much to Eurosport for sponsoring the cycling podcast and sponsoring our Pedaleur de Charme award. I managed to catch up finally today with Greg Henderson, gave him his t-shirt. He was obviously delighted. And Lionel, you also caught up with yesterday's Pedaleur de Charme, the Dane.
The Dane, M&M. He rides for Katusha. You probably work out who I'm speaking about. If you read it in English, it looks like Morkoff, but we've been told by our Danish friends that that's not
and
correct.
And yet our linguists here, Seb, you know, you are the master linguist, and you were there casually just calling him Michael Morkoff.
I've been calling him Michael Morkoff ever since he's been in races that I've been working on. But then again, I've also been saying Salers yesterday when we went through the village of Salers, known for its cheese and its meat. And Christian Prudhomme said, no, 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 c'est Salers.
Well, see, I mean, if you've got that wrong and that's in France, I
feel
less bad.
We feel
better
about it.
Anyway, I spoke to Michael at the start this morning.
Michael. Here's Michael.
Michael, if it was any other race, would you be carrying on or would you be pulling out? Because the Tour de France is obviously the biggest race in the world. Is that what keeping you going?
Yeah, it is. You know, other races, I would probably, depends which race, but I would probably go home, recover and be ready for next one. But since we prepared the whole year for this, and I know that I'm very important for Alexander in the sprints, I will keep on fighting until they drag me home.
Can you describe your injuries? What's causing you the most trouble?
It's definitely my leg. I hurt that a lot, and I have troubles with using it. But now it's just like my whole body is kind of shut down. So I just need time to open again.
And does it prevent you from sleeping properly? Is it something that's causing you trouble at night?
I'm sleeping pretty good, so at least that's something that I can take with me.
We've talked a lot about you on the podcast, and I've been criticised by some Danish fans for saying your name incorrectly. Can you tell me how to pronounce your name properly in Danish, please?
Merkel.
Merkel.
Yeah, you're right.
Excellent. I've cracked it at last. Well, our listeners have been following your story this week, and they've nominated you as a Pedaleur de Charme for just fighting through and showing the fighting spirit. And we have a T-shirt for you, if I can present that to you now.
Yeah, it could be nice. And I really appreciate all the support I get here. You know, like, I wouldn't expect it that, this, but yeah, I'm very flattered that people are cheering for me, and that's helped me through the race.
So that puts to bed how to say his surname. I think I got an A+ for pronunciation there.
He was quite impressed, wasn't he? I should say that before all that, we heard the Freeboss file, of course, before our Pedaleur de Charme. Daniel, still on great form. He joined us for the podcast last night. Hopefully he'll be joining us in the flesh again soon. Seb, since you're with us, we thought we'd give you the casting vote on tonight's Pedaleur de Charme. Quite a few nominations. Adam Hansen for bottle work. I mean, you must see the guys who are at the back doing the most of that kind of work. In general, maybe not today, because you're going to pick your Pedaleur de Charme in a moment, but in general, you know, who are the guys who are most active there at the back of the bunch?
Well, it changes from day to day. I mean, if a guy is concerned by the stage, he will not go down to the bottles. But today, for example, Tony Galopin of Lotto Soudal was in charge of going back to the car to get the bottles for his teammates, for Andrew Greipel. But so it changes from day to day.
Pedaleur de Charme then, Seb?
Well, it'll look a lot like the Pedaleur de Charme of yesterday, Michael Morcou. And as of now, I will say Michael Morcou on the radio.
Merku.
Yeah. Okay.
Oh, God. I'm now having a crisis of confidence. So we'll have to listen back to how Michael said it.
I'll say Michael Morcou tomorrow on the Radio Tour if he is dropped. For me, the Pedaleur de Charme is Monsieur Sam Bennett, who has been struggling ever since stage one when he crashed, and he's still there fighting for survival.
And I think a good nomination, because we did an interview with him the other day, and despite the pain that he's clearly in, he was still in good humour and good spirits, still hopeful and optimistic that he could make it through.
Well, yeah, as Michael Morcou said, you know, give up on the Tour de France easily. As Michael says, you don't give up on the Tour de France easily. It's the biggest race in the world. Nobody wants to go home. They will push themselves as hard as they possibly can. Seb, we've mentioned that we've got all 198 riders still in the race after almost a full week. We might lose some tomorrow or Saturday. Is it correct to have the impression that there have been fewer crashes in the first week of the Tour? I mean, normally we are talking about crashes. Have there been crashes that they've just been more minor? They've perhaps not caught the big name riders. Is it pretty much the same out there on the road as it would be any other year? It's just perhaps they're not the big stories.
It's a very different year this year. It really is. We have had very, very few crashes. Thierry Gouvenou was actually telling me it was the first time for a long time that we hadn't had crashes for two consecutive stages. There was a crash yesterday, but it wasn't a major crash. So it is completely different, but I think it's just linked to luck. It's not because the roads are narrower or wider, not because of roadworks. It's just luck. It just happens. And thankfully, we haven't had crashes or major crashes this year.
Right, well, listen, we've been talking a lot about Mark Cavendish and mentioning the old HCC High Road. We have our friends program.
Last thing on Mark Cavendish. You should have seen the smile on his face when he got out of the camper van after today's stage victory, because he had a magnificent watch on his arm given to him by a French designer who sells very, very expensive watches.
Was that given to him today?
It was given to him yesterday, and he was very happy about it. I can't say who it was, but
no, we don't do advertising.
No. But it was probably the price of my apartment.
Wow.
Anyway, that's good to hear. Anyway, Mark Cavendish.
I have a tiny apartment.
HCC High Road, the glory years. We did a friend special earlier this year. You can become a friend of the podcast at thiscyclingpodcast.com for £10. 11 special episodes. We've got the next one coming out on Monday, actually, on the rest day, which is a special on Mont Ventoux that Lionel has been working on all year.
Nearly, yeah.
Well, not nearly,
obviously, but there's, yeah, bits and pieces.
Well, we'll hear a little teaser from that in the next couple of days, but we thought we'd play again a little clip from our friend special from earlier this year on HCC High Road. It features Bob Stapleton, who ran the team and was quite a visionary, Brian Holm, who was a sports director, and Cavendish himself.
Here was a top-level team that had no stars, was looking for every bit of talent they could locate and bring into the team. It just doesn't happen very often.
A lot of the good riders in the peloton were high road riders. Any team would want them.
And we were taking a bet on a bunch of young guys. So why not a Cavendish? You know, he crashed in California and really tore himself up. He fought like a dog. I never forgot that.
Ugly jerseys, horrible bikes, no team cars, nothing was working. I said, wow. I remember Bob said, I want to have a winning team. But you have to win and win and win.
You know, this is a sport where everybody loses. When one guy wins, 180 guys lose.
Become a friend of the podcast for 2016. To sign up, visit www.thecyclingpodcast.com.
You are listening to The Cycling Podcast in association with Rafa. Whoever you are, wherever you ride, whatever the reason, Rafa exists to improve your ride with the finest kit, inspiring stories, and vibrant clubhouses and communities all over the world. See rafa.cc for more information.
Thank you very much indeed to Rafa, who are our wonderful sponsors at the Tour de France. And a reminder that you can follow their alternative coverage of the race at rafa.cc. If you go to More Than a Race, every day there's something there that is interesting. Today it's all about the language of cycling and lots of French expressions that are critical to understanding the sport, and with pronunciation in there as well. There's little embedded players you can hear how to pronounce the various expressions and words connected to cycling. It's really, really good. So thank you very much to them. I'm actually dressed head to foot today in Rafa. I don't know if you noticed, but
very smart, Richard. You do look very smart.
Thank you very much. Mm. So thank you to them. Thank you also to Niederberg Wines, who sponsor our Kilometre Zero series. Sorry, Seb, you know, I want to say something. When I texted Seb earlier today and asked him to join us tonight, he said it was a conditional on having some South African wine.
I'm very sad because 2 days ago we were in the hotel with Team Dimension Data, and they were nice enough to give us a bottle of Niederberg wine, but I was still having my shower. I arrived and there was no wine left, and I arrived today for the podcast, no wine.
Well, we had a bottle last night, didn't we?
We did. Yeah,
but I promise you, Seb, the next time you join us, we will have a bottle of Niederberg for you.
Too late. We do
have a little stock. No. We can't promise you any Rafa clothing, but we will give you some Niederberg wine, definitely. Anyway, you've got to wear your Tour de France team issue clothing. So,
well, not on my rest day.
Oh, okay. Damn. Anyway, that's a promise. What we've got to cover? Oh, I was going to mention Kilometre Zero. We had Kilometre Zero was out today, sponsored by Niederberg. It was on the French Foreign Legion, so a little 15-minute episode on Julien Alaphilippe, Warren Barguil, and Pierre Roland, who all lead or, are top riders for foreign teams. And that's quite a new phenomenon. And it's quite a nice little interview in there with Warren Barguil, who admits that when he moved to Nice, the temptations of FIFA Football Manager and M&Ms proved distracting from his training. Yep. So he moved back to Brittany. A home bird who rides for a foreign team.
So what else have we got, Richard? We've got your chat with Tim Harris.
Yeah, I just caught Tim Harris briefly this morning. Tim Harris, a former British professional champion, actually, who has a house in Belgium and over the years has looked after lots of British riders, one of them being Dan McClay, who was third on the stage today. We spoke to Dan McClay the other day. Tim Harris knows him very well. Let's hear what he had to say. So Tim Harris, former British professional road race champion. You know, I work in the tour, but you also look after bike riders at home in Belgium, and you had Dan McClay for 4 years.
Yeah, Dan McClay, he was riding with the amateur setup of Lotto, and he stayed with me for four seasons.
So what can you tell us about him?
Dan is a very, very shy person, but when you put him on a bicycle, then in the sprint, he'll take some stopping, and now he's had three top tens, and I think he's a rider that in the future could possibly win a stage here.
He's sort of had an unconventional route into the Tour de France. You know, he's here with a small French team and he hasn't come through the British cycling system. Was that, on his part, a very conscious decision, or is that just the way things worked out for him?
No, because, okay, you say it's unconventional. It's unconventional in the last few years because of the British Federation and the academy setup. But before that existed, the only route to be a professional was to come to Europe by yourself. He had always admired how Adam Blythe did it. Didn't really want to ride the track, even though he was Madison World Champion with the juniors, and so came via Belgium, and yes, it's paid off.
Have you been impressed by him at this tour?
No, I mean, I'm not surprised, because he's definitely got the capability to do it, so, you know, but to do it at this level is obviously brilliant.
So that was Tim Harris on Dan McLay, and we'll probably catch up with Dan McLay again. I mean, he's knocking on the door, isn't he? He's close to a stage when it might happen for him. You look at some of the names behind him, you know, Alexander Kristoff, Peter Sagan, Dylan Groenewegen, Brian Cockard.
Andre Greipel, well done.
Yeah, Andre Greipel's not been firing at all, has he? But very impressive indeed by Dan McLay. Now, you've got to rush off, haven't you, Seb, because there's a football match tonight.
Yeah, exactly, and it doesn't concern Scotland or England.
Oh,
and you're going to be watching in Toulouse, where you're headed. Toulouse,
indeed. I think I won't be the only one to watch. I know the all the other French riders, Galopin, Thibaut Pinot, who thinks that France will win 2-1, are going to be in front of their TV screens.
What about the Germans? They'll be watching as well.
I know that Marcel Kittel normally watches the games with Tony Martin, so he'll certainly be watching.
Well, they've got Alaphilippe in the team, as we mentioned, so, you know, a bit of internal
team. There's going to be some needle at breakfast, isn't there?
Bit of needle, yeah.
I don't like when you mention Alaphilippe.
You what, sorry?
I don't really like when you mention Julien Alaphilippe.
Why is that?
Oh, I just like that.
He's anticipating walking to Paris.
Oh, sorry, I forgot about that already. My brain is not working, of course. You look quite nervous every time his name is mentioned. He's running very well.
Now, to be honest, I hope he'll get a great result. I'm pretty confident he won't win the Tour de France.
We don't want to extrapolate too much from yesterday's stage, but he was hanging on a little bit in that leading group.
Yeah, he was just in front of our car. He's really, really struggling, and obviously he's not used to three-week races, so I wouldn't be surprised if tomorrow he struggles even more.
Someone with a vested interest there. Anyway, we should wrap things up for tonight. We'll be back tomorrow, of course, as we are every day. Thank you very much, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Seb.
A bientôt.
Oh, no, hang on. We've got one more thing to do tonight.
Have we?
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah, you've got an email to read out, Lionel. Oh. Yeah. We should also say we get lots of emails and... And?
We do. I haven't told you what the contents of this email are, so it will be a surprise to you. But I did say there's an email I wanted to read to you. We get a lot of emails while we're here at the Tour de France. Apologies if we don't reply terribly quickly. There's just the three of us while we're here at the Tour, and there isn't always time to get to our correspondents. But we do read every message that gets sent to us, and we do appreciate them all, even the slightly critical ones.
Mainly about pronunciation.
It's fine. We're learning. That's the best thing, isn't it? We are learning. We're learning from, I don't want to say the horse's mouth.
We all start off as writers. You don't need to know how to pronounce things when you write do you?
Exactly. Anyway, ironically, Andrew Bach or Baish from Blackpool. I'm really sorry, Andrew. It's not a name that's familiar to me. But the subject of his email is The Buffalo, which is your nickname, Richard, amongst friends. And he's been listening to the podcast since before the Giro, and he's thoroughly enjoyed listening. And he is in a band called Troubadour, and they have a track called Buffalo. And I thought that we could play out with that this evening.
Well, what does his email say? Is that what it says? I thought you were going to read out the email. I've been looking forward to that all day.
The email's pretty long. But basically, he says he's a keen cyclist and watcher of bike races. He's been listening to the podcast since before the Giro. Thoroughly enjoys the coverage. And he's looking forward to catching up on the rest of them during his summer holidays. When he's not cycling, he's in a band in Blackpool called Troubadour. I mean, I paraphrased and now I'm reading it out. I mean, what's the point of this? Anyway, he says they've got a track called Buffalo. And in the light of your theme tunes for several of your guests, I thought it might be nice for Richard to have his own theme tune. There's a link to the track on SoundCloud below. And he's offering to send us a CD and instrumental versions as well if we want. So thank you very much, Andy. And here is Troubadour's track. Buffalo.
Survive like a buffalo that's moving in the shadows, hiding from the arrows, bullets, and the bonfires. Glow like the firefly, tall like the skyline, strong in the mind, steady as the moving tide. I'm like the boxer longing for that second fight.